You're listening to another episode of the Young Investors Podcast, so sit back and relax as myself, Hamish, and my buddy Brandon discuss the latest in the world of finance and stock market investing. Now, a quick reminder before we get into the podcast is that nothing in this podcast should be taken on as personal financial advice. If you're ever unsure about your finances or investing, make sure you reach out to a qualified financial advisor. But with that said, let's get into another episode of the Young Investors Podcast.
All right, guys, welcome back to the Young Investors Podcast. Mm. Did you like that new intro? Did you like it?
Yeah, we fixed it.
I'm joined, of course, by Hamish and Hamish, the two Hamishes.
Yeah, we fixed the intro. Everyone was wondering who this Brandon guy is. We still got more comments about who Brandon is. So I went ahead and fixed it. We now know who Brandon is. We just don't
That's me, guys.
We just don't know who Hamish is now.
Now we don't know.
We actually do have a new intro that we'll run next week. But I thought
next week we couldn't resist.
I couldn't resist doing the opposite of Brandon's confusing intro that's been in place for how many years now? Four years, I think.
Bit over
4 years that's been in place. For 4 years, we've been getting asked, "Who is Brandon?
Who's Brandon?"
So we finally fixed it. But
yeah, it's my buddy Brandon.
Oh dear, so funny.
No, wait, no, I don't say that.
No,
I
say you say your buddy Hamish.
Brandon. Yeah. No, it's my buddy Hamish. Yeah, my bad.
Yeah.
gosh.
No, it was anyway. It was good. I think it was time we updated the intro. So hopefully guys enjoyed that, and it was definitely overdue to have an intro that fitted the fact that we have a video podcast as well as an audio podcast. I think that was necessary. But what's been happening? How's Canberra? How's Canberra treating you?
Canberra's good. Yeah, it's a good day today. You know, it's been actually it was cold and windy, but no, Canberra's good. Yeah, having a good time. Same as usual. We've been making lots of content going out the door, which is good. We're going to be remaking some course content, so we got to get started on that pretty soon. We've been planning that out, but you won't see that for a long time. It's going to take. It's a big effort. We're only just starting. But one exciting bit of news that I have to share is that not yesterday, the day before, I got to interview Mr. Guy Spear.
Oh yeah! People.
So that was very, very exciting. He's such a nice guy.
He is.
You know how when you see people online and you're like, I wonder what they're like actually in real life, whether they're the same, like, perfect, you know, lovely person. Guy is absolutely the same lovely person.
Yeah.
He's so, so nice.
He's great.
We actually spoke before we'd even press record. We spoke for an hour.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah. I was like, Guy, like, I don't want to take up too much of your time. Like, you got to flip and read some annual reports or listen to something, you know? Yeah. I don't know. You're an investor managing hundreds of millions of dollars. He's like, nah, this is interesting. Let's have a chat about YouTube and Google and all this sort of stuff. So it was, really, really good talking to Guy. So I ended up, actually, the recorded section where we spoke about investing stuff went for about 45 minutes. So I think what we're going to do is that that will be in your ears as next week's podcast episode. And then I'll make some proper, you know, new money style videos on the channel with clips from that interview as well, if you want to follow. So if you don't follow me over on YouTube, please do.
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to that.
Please follow our YouTube efforts.
What did you guys end up talking about, just generally, not to give too much away for your the videos that you'll have coming up?
You shall see. Now, I asked him about, because obviously he's an active fund manager. He picks stocks for a living, and he has beaten the S&P 500 over the long run. So I kind of asked him how he's done that, what tips, you know, whether he believes in passive investing and like that strategy for new investors, what to look for in a fund manager that is more likely to beat the S&P 500. He spoke about how it's really, really, really hard to do, and even he's only beat it by a slight little bit. But his book, Education of Value Investors, is very much around like, you know, setting up your environment so that you don't succumb to those mental weaknesses like the fear, uncertainty, doubt, the FOMO, all that sort of stuff. So he spoke about like some practical steps to implement to make sure that you don't kind of fall into that. Spoke about, heaps of stuff. He's got some investing checklist items that he wrote about in his book, which are now no longer true. So he spoke about his updated thoughts on that. There was a lot of stuff. But, very excited for you guys to hear that next week.
Fantastic.
It was great. Yeah. Great conversation. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it. Today we have a few interesting things to talk about. You've got a story on Warren Buffett. He's been buying more Occidental Petroleum.
He's buying Oxy.
He's still going. He hasn't stopped.
He just doesn't stop.
No, he's just been a consistent buyer over the past, year, a little bit over a year or so. So I'm interested to hear about that story. We've got an RBA, Reserve Bank of Australia, interest rate increase. Another rate hike has been pushed through. I want to talk about Lego, which is a private company, but we do have 2022 financial results for Lego, and it's a really interesting case study. Lego is one of those businesses that always comes up where when we ask kind of what private businesses do you wish you could invest in that you couldn't? Like I always say kind of Red Bull, IKEA is another one, and Lego is always thrown in there. And I've never actually taken
such a strong brand.
It's an incredible brand, and it's been around for 90 years now. This is its 90th financial year.
Wow.
And it's a business that I hadn't looked super in depth into before, but come the financial results, I wanted to take a look. And the numbers don't lie. It's an incredible business. So I think it'll be an interesting kind of case study to see a business that we wish we could invest in. Was that everything we had?
I'll talk a little bit about Jerome Powell. There's nothing too much to add. He testified before US Senate Banking, Housing and Urban Affairs Committee hearing. So we'll talk about what he said. But that's pretty much, I think we'll just end up going through a couple of Q&A questions towards the end because, there's some interesting stuff to talk about, but generally speaking this week, news cycle is a bit dead, little bit dead.
Yeah.
But that just means more banter.
Exactly. We will fill the hour.
Well, we shall. It is our duty. It is our obligation. No, we shall fill it with absolute just garbage. But we shall ramble.
We will feel it. No, I'm actually glad you mentioned the Q&As early because, we're running out of questions. So if you have any questions and you want to get a question on the next week's episode or an episode in the future, then make sure you head over to the YouTube version of the podcast and just click on the latest episode and then leave your questions as a comment. Or if you're on Spotify, you don't even need to do that. Just scroll up below in the Spotify app and you'll find a spot there where you can ask a question. So either of those two places, and we try to get to a couple of questions every week. But with that said, I think we'll get underway. So today's episode is sponsored by ShareSite, which is an application you can use to track the performance of your stock portfolio. So you can essentially bring in all of your trades by connecting ShareSite to your broker. It's super easy. Or if you don't want to do that, you can go into your broker, download your trades using Excel, super easy as well, and just import them into ShareSite. And once it does that, it will track all the gains and losses in your portfolio. So capital gains, dividends. If you have dividend reinvestment plans, so on like an ETF might have a reinvestment plan, it will do those calculations for you, which is an absolute lifesaver, something that's really hard to do by yourself on Excel. It's nearly impossible to do on Excel by yourself. Currency gains, if you're buying shares internationally or you hold foreign currency, so if you're Australian like me and you invest in American companies, you have to be tracking those the exchange rate essentially because it affects your real return once you convert those shares back into Australian dollars. So being able to track all of those things automatically is just an absolute lifesaver. And then the main reason why I use ShareSite is for when it comes to tax time. So ShareSite generates up to 12 different reports that can be used at tax time to work out things such as capital gains, dividend income, and more. And at the moment, you can try ShareSite for free by heading over to ShareSite.com/younginvestors. So that's site spelled SIGHT, ShareSite.com/younginvestors. So you use that link, you can sign up to a free plan and track up to 10 holdings for as long as you want. So if you have a pretty concentrated portfolio, you can get away with using ShareSite's free account. Or if you want to sign up for more holdings, more reporting, that kind of thing, then you can get 4 months off an annual subscription if you sign up using our link. So go check it out. If you haven't already, it's completely risk-free. You can try the free plan for as long as you want. And as always, thank you to the people who sign up to ShareSite through our link and are supporting the podcast.
Yes, absolutely. Where do you want to start today?
I did actually want to start. I want to jump in and talk about, we got some feedback or a comment in regards to the buyback discussion that we had last week. And there was a component of that discussion. I spent a bit more time talking about the political situation with buybacks and less about Well, tax is involved in the political part, but I missed a key component of it. And there was a comment that kind of pointed this out. So I wanted to dive into that discussion just a little bit, just to cover something that is important, but I kind of missed in the discussion last week, which sometimes happens just because we're kind of constrained a little bit by time and it's off the cuff. So, you know, that kind of happens from time to time. But the comment was, you're being really disingenuous on the buyback topic. The issue is that the tax-free nature of buybacks versus dividends, Buffett is crying because if he has to pay dividends to himself, then after tax purchase his company shares, it is tax inefficient. When a company buys back its shares, it's a 0% dividend tax. And you are correct to kind of some extent, but I kind of want to give complete clarity on the kind of the tax situation between dividends and buybacks because it's not as tax generous as I think some people think it is. So when a company pays a dividend, first of all, the company has paid corporate tax, right? So they've brought in the revenue, they have expenses, then they pay tax, and then they use that after-tax income to pay a dividend. And as they pay that dividend to individuals, there's a second tax event. So the individual, of course, has to pay income tax. So there's kind of the company tax event and then the individual tax event. When it comes to a buyback, the company has still paid the corporate tax event. However, they don't have that second personal income tax event, so to speak. So they can repurchase the shares without a tax event, although now there's kind of a 1% excise tax. So there's like a small tax event, but there's no tax event that goes to all investors in the company. But there is still a second tax event, and this is an important thing to understand. There's only a tax difference really if you remain a shareholder, right? Because when a company buys back its stock, there has to be investors on the other side who are selling their stock and essentially collecting that buyback money. And those investors still pay income tax, right? If a company spends $10 billion on dividends versus buybacks, that's $10 that are still being distributed to shareholders. It's just whether the $10 billion is distributed evenly to every investor or whether it's being distributed to a portion of investors who have sold out of the company. So I think that's an important kind of distinction to understand. It's not a tax-free event. It's just if you're a long-term investor and you want to hold the stock, then you don't have that second tax event. You don't have to take the dividend, pay tax on it, and then buy more shares. So I think that's kind of important to understand. But yes, that is a key component that we didn't really talk kind of too much about last week.
I'm a dummy when it comes to tax. That's one thing I never talk about because I just get my accountant. He sorts it all out. I just go to Scott and say, Scott, what do I do?
Yeah. No, I am too. And I'm glad you brought that up because what I'm talking about here, of course, is tax in the US. It's different in other places. It's different depending if you're an individual collecting a dividend or a trust or a car. It could be the specific tax circumstances are always different. So,
in Australia, we have franking credits. So, exactly. Which cancels out the secondary tax event when we get paid a dividend in some cases, if there is a franking credit on a dividend. So, there's a lot. It's not one system. Depending on where you are in the world, your tax code will be different. So, always worth considering all of the things. Just talk to a tax accountant. They'll help. that's my input. no, but very interesting. Yeah, no, that makes sense. I'm glad you came through and clarified that because, it's something that I'd not thought about either. So, that was good. Anything more on that topic?
That's pretty much it. Where do you want to go from here? Do you want to talk us through Warren Buffett's...
Sure.
His new purchase?
Yes. So Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway buys more Occidental Petroleum shares. Oh my gosh. He has bought so many shares in this company. So it says here, Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway added to its already large Occidental Petroleum stake during the week. A regulatory filing revealed on Tuesday evening. The Omaha, Nebraska-based conglomerate bought nearly 5.8 million shares of the oil company in a few separate trades on Friday, Monday, and Tuesday, paying prices in a range from $59.85 to $61.90, the filings showed. Okay, so $59 to $62-ish. The latest purchase, totaling more than $350 million, marked the first time the Oracle of Omaha hiked his bet since September last year. Mm. So Berkshire Hathaway now owns 200.2 million shares of Occidental, worth $12.2 billion, based on Tuesday's close of $60.85. The conglomerate now holds 22.2% of the oil company, up from 21.4% previously. They own 22% of Occidental.
That's crazy.
This is interesting, especially because Buffett's always just like, we don't want to own more than 10% because then we have to file more. And the admin team doesn't want to do all that filing. He's like, nah, screw it. I'm going to buy 22, almost a quarter now, almost a quarter of the company.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say is now that he owns, well, he's owned it for quite a while, but the fact that he owns more than 10% means that as soon as he makes a trade, I think it's 2 days. I think 2 days after the trade, he has to file.
Not sure. Very soon.
That's how we know of this trade. For example, you might be wondering, why don't we have to wait to a 13F to see this? Well, it's because he owns more than 10% of the company. So every time he trades now, it's within 2 days, he has to tell us exactly what he did. Right. Last few years when I've looked at Buffett's investments, it's not been uncommon for him to buy 9.9% of the company just to stay right underneath, because it's not just about publicly reporting. There's a lot more scrutiny as well that comes with the investment. So you kind of see him sit right below that 10% mark. But yeah, he's not holding back.
And then the company will do a buyback and he's like, oh, God damn it.
Yeah. He pushes him over.
Sell.
Yeah, I can't remember which company that happened. That did happen to a couple of, maybe the airlines or something. I remember he held 9.9% of a few airlines and then a couple of them were pushed over. But yeah.
That's right. So he wanted to get it down. Yeah, that's true. I think that's what happened. Yeah, very interesting. Occidental, now among Berkshire's top 10 holdings, has seen its stock retreat about 3% this year following a stellar 2022. The energy name was, get this, the best performer in the S&P 500 last year.
How much of that is price. Occidental, and how much of that is the Buffett effect?
Buffett's, well, he just doesn't get how this works. He's out there buying and he's watching the stock price go up and he's like, oh, look, keep buying. It's still going up.
No, well, I mean, it is kind of, it's a real point, because you not only have people following Buffett into investments at a significant degree, but yeah, to buy 20% of any company is probably going to force the shares up quite considerably. So it is interesting. It's interesting that it was the best performer.
Yeah, although not as much as maybe we might expect, because remember how Buffett was like, remember how last year was like, it's amazing, we bought like 10% of the company in 2 weeks, and just because the sheer like volume of people just like going in, getting out, going trading, in, getting out, going in. But no, you're right. If you add an additional, 20% of the company to the buying pressure, then even over a long period of time, you're right. Yeah, it's definitely going to go up because of Warren Buffett to some extent. That extent, I'm not sure of, but it was interesting. So on Monday, Occidental CEO Vicky Holub said in an interview with CNBC's Brian Sullivan that she met with the 92-year-old investor just a few days ago. Holub said they talked about the oil and gas industry and the technology involved in it. So I actually watched the CNBC clip of this interview. It's really interesting. She noted that she was asked, hey, oil price is pretty high, price at the pump. Do you guys have the capacity to produce more oil? And she said they do have the potential to produce more oil. But in the same sentence, she also said that they have a value proposition that includes an active share buyback program and a growing dividend, and they want to maximize their return on capital employed. So she said, quote, they're very careful how they structure their capital programs on an annual basis to ensure they still have sufficient cash to buy back shares.
Interesting.
And when she was asked, why not use that money to drill more wells and pump more oil to help lower fuel prices, she said, well, I think prices are at a good place right now, AKA they don't want to bring down oil prices at all. Because the way that this kind of works, if oil prices are high and oil producers can do nothing and make a whole lot more money, That's what they're going to do.
They're going to do it.
Yeah, that's exactly what they're going to do, because they don't have to do anything to make more money. Yes, they could invest heavily in pumping more oil, but that's going to cost money to do that. It's easier for them to just sit back and let the prices go up and just rake in the profits. Of course, there's still going to be an increase in pumping. So they noted that they grew their output by 12% last year. But yeah, they want to balance. They want to really think about where every dollar is best spent for their owners, for their shareholders. And sometimes increasing output is just not the best use. So what else did I say? Ultimately, that strategy leads to more profit for less work, and it means they can give more money to shareholders. Yep, that was my point. So interestingly, this year, Occidental authorized a new $3 billion share repurchase authorization and a 38% increase to its dividend. It completed $3 billion in share repurchases last year, with $562 million of repurchases in the fourth quarter.
Interesting.
So, thoughts on, I don't know, oil companies not actually doing anything to pump more oil, but just raking in extra profits? Well, I mean, it makes sense, right? You want to think about where your money is best utilized.
Yeah, it's interesting, because this does kind of speak directly into the whole buyback thing that we were talking about last week, which is the kind of Democratic position is that they want companies to invest more in their people, invest more in their companies, rather than just, you know, sitting back and distributing capital to shareholders. When it comes to oil companies, I have no idea. I have no idea whether they could invest more into their production and that it would actually be an effective use of capital. That's kind of the other argument, is that, well, if they can't effectively use it, if pumping more oil isn't going to generate higher returns, then it should be distributed so that money can be invested in other businesses. That's kind of the argument. I don't have any understanding on how capital is invested in oil companies, and I would imagine it's a pretty cyclical business, I think. So I have no idea whether Occidental, I don't have an opinion, let's say, on whether they should be investing more in pumping oil. But yeah, it's certainly interesting, because it is kind of a very explicit example of the whole kind of buyback situation, especially with what you just said, the CEO, how they described it, that, nah, we're not going to invest more. We're happy where prices are. We'll just keep distributing to investors. So it is interesting.
In August, Berkshire received regulatory approval to purchase up to 50% of the company. 50%, spurring speculation it may eventually buy all of the Houston-based Occidental company.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's right. Because I remember now, when we went to that Astros game, we saw the big Oxy logo up at their stadium. That's right. I didn't know they were Houston-based.
Yeah.
It all makes sense now, Hamish. But there you go. Could Warren Buffett, I mean, what would happen? He would buy all of Oxy and it would slot into Berkshire Hathaway Energy, I imagine.
Yeah, pretty much. Interesting to see him go this approach. I wonder if he ever tried to buy the whole company from management, and maybe there wasn't an option for that. So he's just like, well, I'm just going to do a hostile takeover anyway. I'm coming whether you like it or not. it is interesting to see that. Obviously, this is the other way that companies can buy whole businesses. They just start buying the stock on the public markets and force a board vote to make the sale. And we may end up, I guess, seeing that maybe over the next couple of years. Interesting.
Who knows? That would be interesting. Ooh. It's just something about the words hostile takeover.
It sounds great, doesn't it?
It sounds great. We're going to complete a hostile takeover.
Yeah.
It's like, ooh, tell me more. Berkshire also owns $10 billion of Occidental preferred stock and warrants to buy another 83.9 million common shares for $5 billion, or $59.62 each. The warrants were obtained as a part of the company's 2019 deal that helped finance Occidental's purchase of, Anadarko. Don't know what that is, but there you go. Cool. there we go. That is Warren Buffett buying more Occidental Petroleum, Hamish Hodder.
Incredible.
Can we talk about Lego? I just want to play with my Lego, Hamish.
Yeah, talking about Lego. Were you a Lego guy?
Oh, absolutely. Star Wars Lego. Get around. Yeah.
Star Wars Lego. I don't think I ever had Lego. I can't remember. I don't think so. I think...
That's like...
Did I have Lego?
Torture.
Yeah, I don't know. What did I do as a kid?
It's like child abuse. Not having Lego.
Child abuse. Dear. That's their new ad campaign. Your kid doesn't have Lego? You're abusive.
Lego starts running campaigns like, oh my gosh. Ay, ay, ay.
All right.
We're drifting off course, Hamish.
No, but yeah, so Lego is the Lego group is it's a private company. So we don't talk about Lego too much, except as I mentioned, when we're asking kind of what are some of the private companies that we wish we could invest in. There's a lot of public companies out there, but unfortunately, some of the best companies are private, and it kind of makes sense that some of the best businesses are private, because public markets are a means of getting capital. And while getting access to new investor capital is something that most businesses need, not all of them do. And especially if it's a really well-run business, then it can just stay as a family business. And that's what you see with companies like, I'm actually not sure who owns IKEA anymore, but Red Bull is still a family-owned company. And Lego slots in as one of those businesses that is family-owned. So it's a private business, but
if you've got all the money you need, if you've got all the money you need, why would you bother going public, having all these extra filings and all the conference calls and having to talk to the shareholder? Like, why would you bother? It's so much easier. And also all the analysts and the scrutiny and the media, because you're a publicly traded stock, and then the short sellers, they want to have an influence. It's just so, this is something I didn't appreciate until more recently. If you are a private company and you're just humming away, doing your thing, it's so nice just to stay as a private company. Like, just don't go public. There's just so many strings attached, so much red tape. It's just not worth it.
Yeah. The unfortunate reality is for most businesses, they just need a huge injection of capital to scale quick enough to compete. And you see that with almost every tech business, right? Companies like Apple, for example, like it was a very small business, and then, Steve Jobs wanted to scale, wanted to compete in a big way. And you can raise billions of dollars doing that if you have a really good business. So it can be a really quick way to scale. But Lego is one of those businesses that kind of didn't need to do that. But they still report earnings. So you can go back and look at all of their annual reports if you want. Most private companies don't do that, but Lego does that. And part of it is because a quarter of the business is owned by the Lego Foundation. So a quarter of the business is kind of going into charity. So I'd imagine that feeds into quite a big reason why they decide to do their full annual reports. But to give a bit of a background on Lego, before I get into some of the financial results and the business, it's a Danish company that was founded in 1932 by Kirk Christensen. It's in its 90th year at the moment, or 91st year in 2023. And Lego is derived from the Danish phrase "leg god," which means play well. So that's where the name comes from. And as I mentioned, it's owned 25% by the Lego Foundation, and the remaining 75% is owned by the Christensen family. So it's still a completely family-owned business. They've never had to seek outside capital, which is quite an amazing feat. And there's really two kind of reasons why Lego ultimately won, because you might think, well, it's just they're just blocks. Like, how did they manage to build this brand that we all know? Everyone knows the name Lego, and there's not really any close competitors. It's not like there's Lego and then there's, another close rival that a lot of people own. It's just, let's get Lego. It's just Lego. So it is kind of crazy. And Lego actually wasn't the first to do that block design. There was a company called Kiddycraft, which was the first to do that, small rectangular block design. And Lego at the time was actually still making wood toys. They started out as a wood toy maker. And then they kind of transitioned into following Kiddycraft with the block design. And there's kind of two reasons why Lego became Lego. One is because they've always had this consistent ability to improve on the design. And they did a lot of this through the 50s. But even to today, they've continually worked on making the blocks better, whether it's recognizing the limitations of plastic manufacturing in the 50s and changing the designs so that they would be more resilient over time. That was a big difference between the Kiddycraft ones and the Lego ones. The Lego ones were more resilient. They kind of lasted. They didn't warp. And that was just an innovation that seems relatively simple, but it's one of the many things that they did over time and that ultimately led to them getting their own patent that was unique and allowed them to defend the Lego block that we know today. And then kind of the other side of it is their marketing strategy. So through the 50s, they essentially decided to cut out all of their other lines of products and just focus on the blocks to keep the business as simple as possible. So that Lego, as I said, it used to be, they used to have like wooden toys and all these accessories and that sort of thing. And then they just streamlined it into Lego is the building blocks. That's it. Lego is the building blocks.
Right.
And that, essentially that simple design and simple company meant that their branding and marketing could be very simple and very, very effective. And you mentioned Star Wars. In 1999, they'd faced some problems for some time. And one example of their strong marketing was they entered a massive partnership with Star Wars. And it was actually responsible for a huge reignition of their growth over the last 20 years. And not even just a reignition of their growth, but the fact that they've continued to be able to scale globally for decades.
Yeah.
And that kind of represents like one example of many deals that they did over time to scale. So,
yeah. From what I understand, I don't know this in detail, but from what I understand, that deal with Star Wars was probably like the biggest thing to happen to Lego like ever. Like it was huge. And even still today, when you think about Lego and the brand lines, like right up the top is Star Wars Lego. You know, the X-Wing, the Millennium Falcon, the Ultimate Collector Series, you know, all the kits, you see them in all the stores. It's the first thing that's front and center is Star Wars Lego. It's unreal. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it used to be, and it, before now we've got like Harry Potter Lego, you've got all the, all of the franchises have got Lego. But I remember when I was a kid, around what would it have been? 2004, 2005, 2006, around that time, it was just all Star Wars Lego. That was all it was on the shelves and people just ate it up. They loved it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a fascinating story. We won't kind of go into too much detail here, but there's a ton of great, I've watched a few good YouTube videos on the Lego marketing and Lego brand and the Lego company over the past few decades. And yeah, if anyone's curious, I highly recommend you go watch it because it, like Coca-Cola, like Red Bull, they've got these simple, but kind of elegant and very effective marketing strategies that they've just deployed and tweaked over many decades. And it's to me, it's one of the most interesting aspects of businesses, how these massive brands develop. Nike is another one, for example, and how they kind of caught on to partnering with certain athletes or whatever it was that allowed them to scale. So really interesting business. And it certainly shows in their financial results. So in 2022, they had $9.1 billion of revenue. These are, I've kind of converted these into US dollars, up 17% year over year. And they generated that $9 billion in 904 branded Lego stores around the world in 111 countries and then their wholesale sales as well. And they're actually the largest toy company in the world as of 2015.
Wow.
Which is kind of crazy, again, because they have such a simple product line. Like it's such a, it's not as if they, like they're bigger than Hasbro, they're bigger than, I can't remember the name of the other company.
Mattel.
And both of those companies have much wider array of products. So it's fascinating that Lego has been able to surpass both of them with a very simple concept. Their gross margin was 68.8%, which is a huge gross margin. And it really speaks to the massive amount of markup that they're able to charge over the cost of the materials. And that is a really, just there is a really good example of likely a couple of factors that are competitive advantages that Lego has. One is their brand power, which allows them to charge higher prices. And the other is their scale economics, which probably allows them to spread their costs across more units and lower their unit costs. So both of those two things has allowed them to, both of those kind of deep economic moats, so to speak, have allowed them to charge, you know, 70% gross margin, which is incredibly high.
And I think now as well, their strategy is, because they have obviously all these different types of bricks, they've all got their identification numbers, and I think now the makers of the sets, and they have all the different bricks and all the different colors and whatever, but they know what those things are. And I think now what they get is they've got a big focus, the makers of the sets, when they're designing new sets, they try and only use the bricks that they've already, like, they try and create as few unique bricks for the set as possible.
Yeah.
So that they can it's just like,
like they don't need seven of those and four of those and
exactly.
three of those.
Yeah. And you're exactly right. I mean, you don't have to, if you can do that, if you just intelligent design, you don't have to create new bricks. You don't have to put in a new manufacturing line for that type of brick. And then it's just so easy because you're creating these amazing structures that kids love and the brand is there. But you're right. All you're doing is making a silly old little plastic brick. How much is that going to cost you? It's going to cost you less than nothing. It's so easy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, for sure. And a point you made earlier, which was about the benefit of being private versus going public. One thing, there's been kind of a few times over LEGO's long history where they haven't been able to grow and they've just kind of been grinding out what they do. And then in a little bit of time, they've kind of figured out how to scale. A lot of public companies really just don't go through those kind of grindy periods. They often just bend to investors and they start making crazy acquisitions. They start going, whoa, we need to buy something. We need revenue to go up. So we have to buy something. And that's something that LEGO hasn't been, they haven't been kind of at the mercy of investors to do that. They've just had this family business essentially that's a giant, and there's really no pressure for them to kind of move into these different product lines and stay away. They're able to stay true to what they've always done. Net profit came in at $2.5 billion, which was up only 4% year over year, which is a big slowdown from the 31% growth they had the year before, and is a slowdown as a result of cost pressures given the inflation environment and kind of a little bit of muted consumer demand. But especially if you compare it to the other big toy makers, Mattel and Hasbro, they did very well. Mattel had kind of flat sales, and Hasbro actually saw a 9% decline in sales in 2022. So compared to their big competitors, LEGO held up very well. And they had a net profit margin of 21%, which again is insane for a business producing physical products, selling physical toys. That margin really does represent the massive pricing power that they have over the competition. I mean, there are similar products out there. I believe they don't even have, I'm not sure about their patents at the moment, but I know they lost some of their patents, or they ended in the 80s, but maybe they have new ones now.
Oh, okay.
But there are similar products.
But it's not LEGO.
But people don't buy them, even if they're far cheaper. And that just speaks to their brand power. And ultimately, when we talk about economic moats and competitive advantages, we're really talking about, or what it looks like in a company, is a business that can consistently generate high returns on the capital that they deploy. And that might come in a couple of ways. It might be because they can deploy less capital for the same profits, or it could be because they can produce more profit for the same capital deployed. And it's that latter situation, which is the situation for LEGO. So you can imagine the capital deployed is kind of like the factories, mostly where they're manufacturing the Legos. That's going to be pretty similar from business to business. Where the difference is in returns is in the profitability. And as I kind of mentioned, it's because they're able to price their products higher, and likely also because of their scale, they're able to kind of reduce their costs. But their return on equity in 2022 was 44%, and it's been between 40 and 50% for many years, which is just an insane.
Not bad.
Yeah, it's not a bad return on equity. Their return on invested capital was 78%,
which is astronomical.
It's an incredible business that's generating high returns on capital. It's also been able to grow a lot with very little reinvestment. They pay out most of their earnings as dividends. As dividends. And you know, that goes to the charity and it goes to the family as well, as I kind of mentioned. And, it's pretty much exactly what Warren Buffett would describe as a great business. One that's very, very effective use of capital and can grow over many, many years. So it's a very interesting case study. I recommend anyone go and read the annual report if you're curious, because everything just looks great. I mean, they have very little liabilities. It's a very safe business, lots of equity, growing equity, hardly any debt. It's and they're putting out these kind of numbers. So yeah, it's very fascinating.
Yeah. It's kind of sad because, like, if they went public, I would be like, oh. But at the same time, I'd be like, wait a second. Why are you guys going public?
Hang on a second. Why is the family selling?
What's happening here? Yeah. But no, that's, you're right. That's, that is a company with a moat.
I think it's safe to say, yes, they do. They probably have a moat. Yeah.
They have a moat. They have a brand moat. Correct. Yeah, that's unreal. That's so true, though. Nobody buys any of the competitive. I couldn't even describe, like, tell you what the next biggest brand in buildable bricks are.
No.
Toy bricks. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's Lego or bust. It really is.
Yeah. It's, it's an incredible, incredible business. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Definitely one we will continue to admire from afar. All right. With that said, man, I just can't get over that ROE and ROIC. It's just insane. With that said, what should we talk about? I'll talk about good old Jerome.
Jerome.
Our mate Jerome. I don't want to spend too much time harping on this because it's just the same stuff. So Jerome Powell testifies before a U.S. Senate Banking, Housing and Urban Affairs Committee hearing. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell on Tuesday cautioned that interest rates are likely to lead higher than central bank policymakers had expected, citing data earlier this year showing that inflation has reversed the deceleration it showed in late 2022. The central bank leader warned of tighter monetary policy ahead to slow a growing economy. Quote, the latest economic data have come in stronger than expected, which suggests that the ultimate level of interest rates is likely to be higher than previously anticipated, Powell said in remarks prepared for two appearances this week on Capitol Hill. Quote, if the totality of the data were to indicate that faster tightening is warranted, we would be prepared to increase the pace of rate hikes. Those remarks carry two implications. One, that the peak or terminal level of the federal funds rate is likely to be higher than the previous indication from the Fed officials. And two, that the switch last month to smaller quarter percentage point increase in rates could be short-lived if inflation data continues to run hot. Is there anything we haven't heard before in this news story so far, Hamish Hodder?
Not really, but that quote is so funny because it's such a non-quote from Powell. He goes, if the totality of data indicated that faster tightening is warranted, then we would be prepared to increase the rate. So he's basically saying, if the data said that we needed to raise rates faster, we're prepared to raise rates faster. Like, good job.
Yeah.
Well done, Jerome.
Yeah.
You're saying that you will follow the data. And I mean, I guess maybe that's...
I guess that's good.
Like, to me, that's just a given. But yeah, I guess he has to say that, yeah, yes, we will follow the data. And if economic growth is coming in stronger, we will do it.
Does say at the bottom of the paragraph, Powell reiterated that rate decisions will be made meeting by meeting and will be dependent on data and their impact on inflation and economic activity rather than a preset course. So, yes, very obvious, but I guess, yeah, you'd prefer that than just him saying,
yeah,
we're just going to wing it. We're just going to bump it up to like 7%, just see what's going.
Yeah.
What else to say? Stocks fell sharply while Treasury yields jumped after Powell's remarks were released. Market pricing also tilted sharply to a strong possibility of a 0.5 percentage point interest rate hike when the Federal Open Market Committee meetings happen on March 21st and 22nd. Mm. Quote, we've covered a lot of ground and the full effects of our tightening are yet to be felt. Even so, we have more work to do, he added. He said, adding that the road there could be bumpy. So there you go. The chairman faced some pushback from Democrats on the Senate panel who blamed inflation on corporate greed and price gouging and said the Fed should reconsider its rate hikes. Senator Elizabeth Warren, a frequent Powell critic, charged that the Fed's inflation goals will put 2 million people out of work.
Well,
to which he said, quote, "We're taking only the measures we have to bring inflation down," Powell said. Will working people be better off if we just walk away from our jobs and if inflation remains at 5 or 6%? So it's a good point.
Yeah, it's tough to balance.
You've got to do something about it.
Yeah, and I mean, the higher interest rates does have a big effect on everyday people. But the truth is that the interest rates are going to go high one way or another. It's just whether they go now with 6-7% inflation or whether they have to go way higher in an environment where we have 15% inflation. So it's kind of the lesser of two evils. Yes, if you look at what the interest rate increases will likely do for job losses, yeah, it doesn't look good. But if you run the same maths with 12% interest rates, which may be necessary if you let inflation run, it's a hell of a lot worse. So it's just an unfortunate situation that we're in. I mean, it just is what it is. It's the consequence. It's the reaction to the COVID spending, to the war going on in Ukraine, to everything that's kind of happened over the last couple of years. It's just how economics works, unfortunately.
Yep. Indeed. Yes. Lesser of two evils is definitely the way to think about it, I believe. He also said that, get this, he said exactly what he said in his press release. Restoring price stability will likely require that we maintain a restrictive stance of monetary policy for some time. The historical record cautions strongly against prematurely loosening policy. That is copy and paste. We will stay the course until the job is done. That is a copy and paste. Come on, Jerome. At least say something slightly original.
Yeah, no, he's not even using ChatGPT to kind of reword it or anything.
That would be so funny. I would love it if he did something like that. That would be so funny. Anyway, that's all Jerome said. Don't want to harp on about it because nothing's different.
Yeah. And I thought, you know, maybe just slightly related to that, I can just add something that I kind of see with these rate changes is it does take a while for it to kind of flow through the economy. But when it comes to businesses that have that are kind of discretionary purchases, so not necessary purchases, that are done with a lot of financing, that's where you see it first because the rate hikes get directly put into the additional cost it is to buy those things. Like automobiles is one of them and RVs is another one. I invested in an RV company, so I get to see it. And Thor Industries, which is the biggest RV company in the US, just reported their quarterly earnings and their backlog for their towable RVs declined by 90%. So this time last year, they had $10 billion in backlog orders for towable RVs, which is only one of their segments, but it's one of the biggest. Today, it's $1 billion. So that shows you the dramatic slowdown in demand from last year to this year in RVs. And why is that the case? Well, in part, it's because the cost of an RV has gone up so much because of inflation and material costs, but also because of interest rate increases. And most people buy an RV by financing it because it's $50,000 to $150,000 or more sometimes. So yeah, that's where you kind of start to see the cracks in the economy first is in these not necessary, so discretionary purchases that are done with financing. And then it kind of flows through the rest of the market. So yeah, I just thought that was interesting to add.
Yeah, absolutely. Do we have anything else to talk about or should we move on to Q&A?
Just quickly, I'll just say the RBA raised their interest rates again this week in Australia. So this has kind of been a consistent trend from the Reserve Bank of Australia. They raised the official cash rate by 25 basis points, bringing it to 3.6%, which is the highest rate in 11 years since 2012. And according to Rate City, that would add $77 a month in repayments to a $500,000 home loan and $160 per month to a $1 million mortgage. And in total now, rate hikes since last year, mortgage payments have increased more than $1,000 per month for a $500,000 mortgage, which is...
Wow, that's significant.
Very, very significant. So yeah, I just wanted to add that in. How are we doing for time? Have we got?
We got 12 minutes. We got plenty of time.
Oh, okay. I'll just quickly read what the governor of the RBA kind of had to say as he pushed through this rate increase. He said, the board expects further tightening of monetary policy will be needed to ensure the inflation returns to target and that this period of high inflation is only temporary. He went on to say, in assessing when and how much further interest rates need to increase, the board will be paying close attention to the developments in the global economy, trends in household spending, and the outlook for inflation and the labor market. Sounds really familiar to what you just said.
It does.
Is this,
it does.
Hang on. Am I reading this right, or is this Jerome?
No, this is Jerome. Jerome?
Is this...
Sorry, deja vu.
It
sounds exactly the same, doesn't it?
It's exactly the same. Australia is in a bit of a different position because our inflation is still still rising, while the US has kind of seen a lot of declines. But certainly it looks like more rate hikes will be needed going forward, unfortunately, to get inflation under control.
Yep. So exciting. My apartment's going to be finished in July, I think. Gosh, I'm just so excited to get a mortgage, Hamish.
Ooh.
Ay, ay, ay. Picked a great time for it, didn't I?
Yeah, well.
It's all right.
You're so close.
So, yeah. Should have locked in my rate 2 years ago. No, it's fine. It's all good. I can't complain. Very interesting. Same story in Australia. Should we move on to some Q&A?
Yes. Yeah, let's do it.
We've got a few questions.
Yeah, I'll ask you. We'll start at the top here.
Okay.
Really important question. How old do you guys have to get before the podcast could no longer be legally called the Young Investors Podcast? That's right. We're under a strict... Well, when we registered our podcast with the Australian government, we could only call it the Young Investors Podcast because we were under the age of 25. So that was a legal requirement to call it the Young Investors Podcast.
Well, I'm no longer under the age of 25. I'm 28. God damn. Good question. What do we call it when it's we're 30, 35, 40? What do we call it?
Well, we've got
the middle-aged investors podcast.
Yeah, we've got time. I still think, to me, young always had meant like under 30. Like I feel like that.
Well. We're around for 2 more years and then I'm going to be replaced.
Yeah, exactly. We'll get a new host.
So, it would just be you.
Yeah, I don't know.
Dear.
I don't know. Even if we're older, then we could still keep the name, I think. I think there's still going to be demand for younger investors, but I don't know. Maybe we'll change the name someday. It definitely hasn't been something we thought about.
We'll probably just keep it as a meme. Be like, remember the time that we were like 26? 25.
Yeah, a constant reminder.
Yeah. All right. Should I ask you this one?
Sure.
Hey guys, don't know if this makes sense, but please help me out here. If all this money is frozen in crypto at the moment, is it actually still in the crypto market? I mean, let's say if Bitcoin is worth, say, 16K, I think this is quite an old question, 16K at the moment, could it be that, let's say, half of its worth is actually frozen, so worth even less, and also can't take... Oh, gosh. I'm not sure. And also can't take the worth of Bitcoin down by that amount. Not quite sure what that's saying. Or is it priced in? Hope you understand what I mean. Be curious to understand how this works. I don't know anything about cryptocurrency, so I'm going to hand that one to you.
Yeah, I don't really know that much either, but I presume this is kind of in relation to FTX and some of the crypto exchanges where people haven't been able to withdraw their money from exchanges, so it's kind of frozen in there. Essentially, when crypto is frozen in an exchange, it's because the exchange doesn't have enough reserves to give you your cryptocurrency back. So if they don't have enough kind of liquid assets available to give you your money back, then they'll freeze the assets and they'll prevent withdrawals because they don't have enough to give to everybody else. When you deposit on an exchange, In the case of like FTX, for example, they actually ended up taking, or it looks like they ended up taking some of those reserves, which they shouldn't have, and were trading with it. And in FTX case, they actually lost a lot of the funds, it looks like, that they were trading with. In other cases, So in that case, when we say crypto is frozen, it's actually, you know, in FTX's case, they don't have enough to pay everyone out. They actually don't have the assets. They're actually gone. So it's not as if they're kind of frozen there. A lot of them are, they're completely gone. In other cases,
it's not there anymore.
Crypto could be frozen simply because the exchange doesn't have enough liquid assets. So they might have enough assets, but they're kind of tied up in investments that take some time to convert into the cryptocurrencies or into US dollars to kind of give to you. So that also could be the case. And with FTX as well, the other thing to kind of consider is that while this court case is going on, they do have some assets which are kind of being frozen, so to speak, where they are just kind of sitting there waiting to be ultimately sold and then used to give some money back to creditors and users who have lost money with FTX. But in terms of how this is priced into the price of Bitcoin, or is there going to be a big sell-off or something like that, I have absolutely no idea. And I don't really think anybody has any idea what kind of effect that could have on the price of it. So, but hopefully that that kind of clears up what it means for the funds to be frozen.
Silly Sam Bankman-Fried. What were you doing, man?
Yeah.
What were you doing?
Ridiculous.
Right. All right. Should we do one or two more?
Yeah. Let me, I'll ask this last one to you because this is targeted at you. Hey guys, love the podcast. Hope you both had a good Christmas and New Year's. We did. This must have been from a little bit earlier in the year.
Yeah.
Brendan, I have a question for you. In step six of the Philtown method of stock valuation in Profitful, you halved the estimated future stock price by 2 for a 15% return over 5 years. I'm assuming you're using the rule of 72. It would be great if you could please confirm this is the case. Both of you guys have taught me so much. Thank you very much. Well, thank you for tuning in.
I can confirm that is the case.
It is?
Done. Yeah, well, it's because if you're running at a 15% annual return, you double your money in 5 years. So that's exactly right. Yep, the rule of 72. Very handy rule. I've forgotten exactly.
Yes,
T equals 72 over R. T is the number of periods required to double an investment's value, and R is the interest rate per period as a percentage.
Yeah. So if you want to work out what the per year compounded rate is to double your money over a certain number of years, you can use the rule of 72. And essentially, it will be the multiple between. So you can kind of multiply the number of years it takes to double and the per year compounded return, and that will add up to 72. So for example, it takes about 7 years. It takes about at a 7% per year annual return, it will take about 10 years or 10 point, a little bit over 10 years to double your money. So that's kind of 7 times 10, which is, you know,
makes sense.
Approximately 72. Yeah. So that's how you kind of work it out.
Interesting. Rule of 72. Okay, let's quickly go through this last one. Hello, thank you for the podcast. It's always great to hear you talk about the news at the end of the week. No worries. Thank you very much for tuning in every week. We appreciate it. I have a question. Where to start when you don't feel like you have a circle of competence? I'm slowly analyzing Costco because it's been, it is an easily understandable business model even, and is almost inarguably a very good business, but I'm still not sure how to form my circle of competence. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your question.
Yeah, I think I think that's a really good question. It can be very overwhelming, I think, to figure out how to understand businesses, especially because a lot of businesses are very complex. A lot of them have different components, different moving parts. Sometimes there's not a lot of good data on those businesses, even in their annual reports.
Data.
Yeah, I know. We got more comments about that. it can be very difficult. My biggest advice is first do what you have done, which is start with an easy to understand business like a Costco. I like, you know, restaurant businesses are relatively easy. They have stores, they produce revenue because people buy food, and then they have really just food and labor costs. It's very, very simple and and property costs, like the leases. Very simple business. So starting with simple businesses, and then something that's really helped me is going back to the first annual report and reading through the business section of the annual reports in kind of chronological order. So you can kind of see what the business was like when it listed publicly. So hopefully it was a really, really simple, easy to understand business then. And you can kind of see how the business has developed and what they've done to develop. So like something like Costco, for example, you'll be able to go back and you'll be able to see, oh, okay, so they had, you know, very few stores across the US and then they expanded by taking their profits and reinvesting them into store expansion. And you can kind of see exactly how they built the business that they are today. And to me, that's a really good way of understanding the whole process. Often there'll also be there might be a biography from a founder or an autobiography from a founder in the company as well, which can give some deeper insights into what has mattered for growing that business. And then also YouTube is also a great resource for learning about different businesses. There's lots of kind of video essays on companies and their marketing strategies and that sort of thing. We spoke about Lego. There's a ton of stuff on Lego, even though it's not a public company. There's a ton of stuff on YouTube about Lego's marketing strategy and why they were more effective than their competition. So those are a couple of things I would suggest.
Yeah, I think just I've said this before, but I'll just say it again. if you don't feel like you have a circle of competence, it's pretty a pretty easy exercise you can do is just think about where you spend your time. What do you do? You know, what's your job? What are you an expert in or close enough to an expert in? And what do you spend your money on? Just list out, answer those three questions. Where do you spend your time? Where do you spend your money? And what do you do? And just write it all down. See if there's some consistent themes. You know, I spend money on video games. I spend time playing video games. I don't work in video games, but, you know, that's 2 out of 3. So I'm like, okay, video games. Yeah, I feel like I know how video games work. You know, I already listened to some video game podcasts. I watch video game related YouTube videos. What's coming out? What developers are making what games? You know, I already have a little bit of an understanding without even quite realizing it about video games. And then from there, it's like, I'll do it right now. Video game stocks. Activision Blizzard, Tencent, Nintendo, Ubisoft, Take-Two Interactive, Electronic Arts. There's a whole list of them. They just come up straight up on Google. That doesn't mean you go out and buy the stocks, but you definitely need to do your research. But that's when you go into what Hamish was saying. Okay, yeah, actually, Activision, oh, Call of Duty. I love Call of Duty, man. It's so awesome. Okay, I better go now. I'll look up Activision Blizzard Investor Relations, and I'll do what Hamish said. I'll look at the annual report. At the start of the annual report, there's a big description about what the business is, and it's very easy to understand. You just got to read through it. It's that this is what we do as a business. This is all the different bits of our business. This is how we make money. This is blah, 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 blah. And then you can just get a bit of a – you just go on a bit of a reading spree. You can do the same thing for Take-Two, Electronic Arts. You start to understand who's the leader in the industry, who has – you know, Tencent has a stake in so many video game companies. It's ridiculous. So you can start to do that and just kind of get a picture of the industry. Once you get a picture of the industry, you can start to look deeper into the financials and whatnot and try and figure out who has the moat, where's the competitive advantage, if there is one, and whether they would make good investments. But yeah, I think that's definitely the way I'd go about starting to look for a circle of competence.
It's a good answer.
Just keep learning. Just keep learning. Like, you can never know too much. Just keep and that's why it helps if you're interested, if you're already interested. Like, I'm already interested in video games. You might not be. Maybe you're interested in, I don't know, construction, for example. Learn about construction companies. Go for it. Construction equipment. Caterpillar, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
So companies like that, you'd be like, oh, wow, this is so cool. Yeah, I used to drive those diggers when I worked in the mines, that kind of thing, you know. Let your interest guide you into an industry, and then from there, go deep on an industry through the different companies that are in there.
That's a fantastic answer, and I think it's a good place to leave today's episode. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. And as always, if you have any questions, as we mentioned at the beginning, head over to the YouTube version of the podcast, click on the latest episode, and leave your questions as a comment, and we'll try and get to a couple each week. Or if you're on Spotify, it's even easier. Just scroll up from below and ask your question within Spotify. Thanks to ShareSite, as always, for sponsoring. ShareSite.com/youngInvestors. Go try a free account or sign up to a paid account and get 4 months off an annual subscription. Thanks, Brandon, for joining me as always. And we will be back next week. No, next week I won't be back.
No, we'll still be back. We'll still be back. We'll do a little intro bit and then we'll lead into the... Yeah, okay, cool.
Perfect.
Nice.
All right, see you later, guys.
See you next week.